and get started, I'd like to call this meeting to order. We would like to thank those in attendance for their attendance at our meeting today. We'd like to excuse those that aren't with us today. I know there was some conflicts, and we appreciate those who have taken the time to attend our meeting. Our first item on the agenda today would be for public comment, but I don't see any public here. Are there any other items that you would like to bring before the board today? Thank you then. Mike, you've got some training for us. If you wouldn't mind, thank you. This is Michael Cragen, who's gonna speak to us.
Good afternoon. The division asked me if I would come and give you my presentation. It takes about 15 minutes. You'll notice that up on the first slide, you might recognize it because I gave it to you last year, but it does have a revision date on it of September of this year, or September of 2014, and that's to reflect a couple of minor changes that the legislature made in its last general session, and when we get together next year, I'm sure there'll be a few more minor changes, and we'll reflect it there. But see if I can point this at the right spot. The legislature has declared in statute that they think that the state, its agencies, and its political subdivisions exist to do the people's business, and the people's business ought to be done in the open. The people ought to be able to participate and to know exactly what's happening. They've defined in statute what an open meeting is, and that is a meeting that is not closed. Further defining a meeting talks about the convening of a public body with a quorum present. Those three terms are important terms. Convening is actually defined saying that a public body has been called together by someone who is authorized to do it. So not just anybody can create a public meeting, but it is important to remember the public body when they get together to talk about or take action upon. So it's even just discussing something over which they have authority brings into play the Open and Public Meetings Act. Definition of a public body has basically five tests. Something that's created by the laws of the state, supported by its taxes, has two or more persons on it, and has some authority to do something. Well, if we look at the State Tax Commission and apply these five tests to it, we see that the Tax Commission is a public body. By contrast, though, the four tax commissioners appoint a tax commission executive director, and that person, like a city manager does in city government, runs the agency, and most of the employees work for that person. Because the executive director is not two or more people, he is not a public body and is not subject to the Open and Public Meetings Act. Now, this advisory board is a public body. And again, it's because it has two or more people, and it has the authority to advise the director of the division in administering the laws. We also have another body called the Farmland Evaluation Advisory Committee. They meet a couple of times a year is all. And every time they meet, I go and give them their presentation. So back to our definition. We know what a public body is, we know what a convening is, we need to also know what a quorum is. In the case of the Open and Public Meetings Act gives a default definition that says that a simple majority constitutes a quorum. Now, in the case of the Tax Commission, there's actually a specific statute that says that three members of the Tax Commission constitute a quorum. So the four tax commissioners, whenever three of them are together, that's a quorum. And they have to follow the act. The statute actually for your board specifies the simple majority as well. So we use the specific statute rather than the default statute under the Open and Public Meetings Act. In the case of the Farmland Advisory Committee, their statute is silent, so the Open and Public Meetings Act default of a simple majority applies to them. So here are the steps for how to conduct an open meeting. You have to adopt a regular meeting schedule. I believe that's on today's agenda, isn't it? Okay, so you'll do that for this year. The Tax Commission has adopted an administrative rule that governs electronic participation in these meetings. Jenny makes sure that at least 24 hours in advance you have an agenda posted. The agenda has to specify what it is you're going to talk about. You can't just put general terms on there. It has to be so that somebody in the public could read it and have some idea what you're doing. If you look on your agenda, you'll see every once in a while there's a little phrase at the end of an agenda item that says action item, and that's so that the people know that you're going to be voting on that action item. We are making a recording, Jenny?
Yes.
Okay, so we turned on the recording. We have to do that. Jenny has to post a copy of that recording on the website so that anybody can listen to it if they want to. And any electronic information presented at the meeting has to be included in the official record of the meeting. This is one of the changes that the legislature made last January. And this presentation falls into this category, and I emailed Jenny a copy of this in advance so that she has it for your record. Okay, at the end of the meeting, some minutes have to be compiled, and they have to be available within 30 days of the meeting. Now, your body only meets a few times a year, so it could be longer than 30 days before you meet again. And the law says, the legislature says, that we need to have those minutes available for the public to look at if they want to in between this meeting and your next meeting. And so Jenny will take care of posting those, but she'll also include a note that says that they may may change as you all review them and decide when to approve them. In your next open meeting, you vote on your minutes, and then they become the official record of the meeting, and they also have to be posted on the website and have to be done within 3 days of your approval. Now, there's no requirement that any public body have a closed meeting, but if a public body decides that they want to have a closed meeting, they have to do it in a certain way, and it has to start out in an open meeting, and at least two-thirds of the members present have to approve of the meeting. I've lost my control here. There are certain things that a public body can discuss in a closed meeting. Those are listed here. Generally speaking, this body is probably not going to talk about the purchase or sale of real property, but you may talk about any of the other items there that are on that list. You have to start in an open meeting, as I said. You have to enter the reason. It has to be one of those reasons that were just on the list, and you have to announce in the public meeting where the meeting will be held. Cannot approve any actions. That means you can't vote on anything during the meeting. And then taking of minutes is optional, but as we'll see here in a moment, a recording is going to be required. So, with the exception of when discussing the character, professional competence, physical or mental health of an individual, or deploying security personnel, devices, or systems, you have to have a recording of the meeting. If it's one of those two exceptions, then the chair in the open meeting has to sign a sworn statement saying that the body only discussed the matters that are allowed to be without a recording. And again, you have to return to an open meeting to take any action. Now, the statute does recognize that sometimes people run into each other and they're not in a meeting. A chance gathering is not a meeting. But the members of a public body cannot use that chance gathering as a way to get around the Open and Public Meetings Act and say, as long as you're here, let's vote on this. A social gathering is also not a meeting under the statute, but it also cannot be used as a way to get around the Open and Public Meetings Act. As long as we're here at the governor's Christmas party, let's take action on something. Can't happen. And then when dealing with certain confidential tax matters, the Utah State Tax Commission is considered to not be in a meeting. We'll talk about those in just a second here. here's a list of what those items are. And we discuss these every week, usually on Tuesdays, with the appeals hearings and the deliberations. The hearings happen all the time. We deliberate then usually on Fridays. The main reason that this part of the law came about is because there are some federal statutes and some state statutes that prohibit us from releasing confidential information. And if we have to meet in a public meeting, we can't talk about that information. So this gives us the ability to comply with both the Open and Public Meetings Act and the confidentiality requirements. Again, that applies only to the Tax Commission. We do have to keep a recording and a make minutes, and those recordings are available for a judge to review if necessary. Now, the one exception to that is that initial hearings by state statute, we are not allowed to make any kind of a record, and the Supreme Court has said our deliberations are a judicial action, and so therefore they're not subject to the Open and Public Meetings Act. I'm sure that's more than you really want to know. Makes my presentation last a little bit longer. A few years ago, there was a bill floating around that was going to prohibit electronic transmissions in public meetings so that you couldn't be texting back and forth amongst yourselves. Somehow, by the time that law passed, it had been changed to say that electronic transmissions are not prohibited. So rather than just abandoning the law, they passed it, but said it's okay for you to text to one another while you're in your meeting. You do have the power to remove a disruptive person. The public can sue you to avoid your final action. I'll just mention to you that if that ever happens, convene a public meeting and vote the right way, and that solves your problem. The public can also compel compliance. A judge can review your closed meeting minutes recordings to determine whether or not you violated the Open and Public Meetings Act, and there are criminal penalties if you violate the closed meeting regulations. The one last thing I need to tell you about is that the law requires you to have annual training on this law, on this topic. Congratulations, you've survived once again. Now, I went through that really fast. If you have questions, I'm happy to explain it in more detail.
The only question that I had, you said that if there was items that had to be voted on, that they had to be specific. But you also said that agenda items had to be specific, and I didn't understand that we had to be specific with agenda items.
The agenda items have to have reasonable specificity. Now, if you're just going to have a general discussion over a subject, like you're going to talk about new car dealers, that's probably specific enough. But if you're going to be voting on whether or not you want to recommend the revocation of a license, you would need to say recommend revocation of a license with action item after it, because you'll be voting on that. So it just depends on the situation what reasonable specificity means. Okay. Other questions I can answer? Thanks for letting me come visit with you again. I understand that you might have some questions about our administrative rulemaking, so I'll stick around in case I can help answer that.
Thank you very much. Thanks. Okay, then let's go ahead and move on to our next item, which is consider approving the minutes from our previous meeting on October 20th, 2014. I was wondering if there was anybody on the board that had any questions with regards to the minutes.
I looked them over and I would approve them.
Okay.
Make a motion to that effect.
Thank you. We have a motion to approve the minutes. Do we have a second?
I would second that.
Thank
John.
You. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Thank you. There was one item on the agenda for this meeting that was coming from those minutes. It had to do with Craig Bickmore, who was going to respond on a topic that we had on brokering. I'll just make a mention that he evidently called and said that they really don't want to pursue it at this time. It's a new car issue. I guess they've discussed it in the new car board, and if they want to delay that for now, I guess it'll come back when they want to do something with it. Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Next item would be to consider approving dates for our board meetings in 2015. Jenny, if you could take a minute on that. You've given us a feel for that in the past. Maybe you've got some tentative ideas.
Well, typically the meetings are held on the third Monday of each quarter. January has been moved to Tuesday because of the holiday. And then last year, people voiced some concern in having a meeting in July just because everybody's out of school and schedules are so busy. So I just went with the third Monday again, which is August 17th for that date. Okay. And that's open for discussion. Any of these dates can be moved if you'd like.
Are Mondays as good a day as any for the other members of the board? They are for me.
They're good for me.
I think so.
Okay. Well, if you have those dates in front of you, is there any questions about those dates, or can we go ahead and have a motion to accept these dates for our meetings in 2015?
John, this is John Watson. I would make that motion to accept those dates.
Thank you very much. Is there a second?
I second it.
Thank you. All in favor that we move to have these dates as our board schedule for 2015, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Thank you. That has passed, Jenny.
We have those people from sales tax here. Do you want to do that question next?
I have a question. Thank you for the sales tax, folks. It's come to our attention that there is some confusion amongst the dealers as to how they handle a trade-in on a vehicle that's currently in a lease. And I don't know the best way to solve this confusion. Obviously that car should not be considered as a trade-in against a purchase. They haven't paid the sales tax on that car, it's a lease. They don't own the car. They can't trade in something that they don't own, but there's still confusion, and I believe there are dealers that are allowing full value trade on vehicles and then paying off a lease. So number one, my question is, have you noticed some problems with that? Is this a something that we need to address? Is this just something that is not a very big problem? It's a big enough problem that some of the board members in the Independent Association have come and said, we've got some confusion on this. Is there anybody there that can talk to that issue?
I don't think we've seen a problem.
Could you come up to the microphone and state who you are so that we can get that?
My name is James Shaw. I'm with the Taxpayer Services Division of the Tax Commission. We haven't seen that problem on our end. Also, our Publication 5, which is the Motor Vehicle Dealers Publication, I believe addresses that situation, that if somebody wants to trade in a leased vehicle, they do have to buy out. They have to buy that vehicle first, pay the sales tax on whatever they're buying the vehicle for before it would be eligible for a trade-in.
Well, I just think there's some confusion on that. Customer comes in and says, I've got this vehicle, here's my payoff. The dealer isn't questioning whether that payoff is coming in the form of a lease payoff or a regular payoff. There definitely are differences the way they're handled, but.
John, I would have a question. This is John Watson. Number one, how is that investigated if there were a problem? I think, as John has mentioned, I think the biggest problem that we have is just maybe oversight. Most dealers are going to know about that. How about someone in the F&I office? And then how is it checked?
Do you know how they do the oversight for that?
I don't. So I'm Jeff Christiansen. I'm a assistant director in Taxpayer Services. A lot of these questions deal mostly with an audit function. We don't have any oversight in going out and making sure how they're handling the trade-ins. All that we do in Taxpayer Services is we provide information on what they should do, such as oversight on the Publication 5, along with auditing and other divisions. So from our perspective, we can assist in trying to see what we can do to educate the public more about what the rules are.
Well, I really think that's our question. We don't want to find out how it works in an audit.
Right.
Okay? Because we might be doing it wrong.
Oh.
And who wants it to be that way? I'm speaking for my association.
Oh, sure.
Okay?
Sure.
So then you said in publication 5, and I'm not sure what that is.
So for certain industries that have a lot of taxability questions, we've created a publication that addresses the major issues
they
have.
How would we get a hold of that publication?
It is on our website, at the tax.utah.gov in the forms and publications section.
And it would specifically address how to handle the tax on a lease vehicle coming in.
That's correct.
It would say that the individual has to buy out the lease before he can trade in the vehicle.
Yes. That's correct.
This typically is addressed annually in the educational portion for, at least I know new car dealers, I speak of them for a moment, that they have this as a topic of discussion every year. And so I think that maybe the education level is a little higher there, but the piece that is a little critical is if one dealer does it appropriately and another dealer doesn't do it appropriately, all of a sudden he's got far and away the advantage in making a transaction for the consumer, which is all in. He doesn't put himself in any kind of position of jeopardy where the dealerships do. And that may be the only issue, but it's still an educational issue in my mind.
Right. Yeah, absolutely an educational issue, and additionally an audit issue, so that they can make sure everybody's being treating everything equally, and not creating competition that's unfair.
Yeah.
Okay, and we are going to make this a topic to make sure that it's covered on our continuing education for this next round. I didn't realize that there was some confusion. It's just come to me through the association that there are some that are not sure they're doing it right.
And we can forward these comments also to auditing to make them aware that there is confusion out there.
John, I don't think the used car side of it's alone by any means. In our board meeting, once in a while, that flag comes up again that maybe someone isn't understanding it exactly the way it should be. And so,
I understand what you're saying too, but let me just throw something at you. The customer comes in, you're saying he has to buy out that lease. Well, let me tell you, the customer doesn't have the money that's going to buy out that lease. Where's that money going to come from? It's coming from the dealer that he's trading that car into. Okay? So then, then it becomes maybe an issue of semantics. Okay? The customer borrows the money from the dealer who makes the payoff, and then it ends up on top of the other car that he's buying or something like that. Is he really buying out the car, or is he not really buying out the car? That's, you see what I'm saying?
All right.
So.
That bears, I think, looking into, really, because I think 90% of the time,
customers don't lease a vehicle, come in and have a $15,000 payoff on their lease and have $15,000 in the bank. That's not the way it works.
Yeah. Or they don't lease a vehicle and when they come to trade it in have the title in their hand because they've made the payoff.
What does it say here?
Yeah, so we've pulled up a copy of that publication 5. In the relevant part it's discussing in here says, a customer who trades in a leased vehicle must first purchase the vehicle and pay any sales or use tax applicable to that purchase before he can receive a trade-in credit.
And how they purchase that
would be up between them and the dealership.
That doesn't mean that that it has to be purchased to be traded in. Oftentimes people finish the lease. They've completed their task of paying and it's inspected, and then they just turn it back to the leasing company and don't pay it off. That is where the critical piece comes, that some dealers are taking that, and let's suppose that the vehicle's worth $25,000. They're putting it on their contract as a vehicle worth $25,000 to lessen the amount of sales tax on the purchase of the new one. And that's really where the root of this comes from. Once in a while, they do pay them off, but not very often. And then if John wanted to buy that vehicle and not have it go back to the leasing company, then he's the one that writes the check to pay it off. Isn't that right, John?
Yeah.
So there's just a little confusion, I think.
But that's basically what it says.
Yes.
Customer buys out the vehicle.
Yes.
And it's up to the leasing company to make sure whatever taxes need to be paid on that vehicle.
That's correct.
Before they give the customer their payoff figure or their buyout figure.
Right, with the trading value.
Okay. All right, thank you for addressing that.
If they were trading.
All right, I'd like to move to the next item for discussion. John? Oh, that's right, thank you. Craig wanted us to call him so that he could address a couple of items before we move to the next.
That'd be great.
Agenda item. We're going to move on to your item there, John, and then we can give Craig one more try after we've finished with that.
I hope mine's not lengthy at all. I just, I've had two or three phone calls from fellow dealers around the state of Utah just in the last couple of months. Most dealers are aware of the fact that there is a law on the books that governs advertising, and there are penalties when advertising laws are not conformed with. Typically, Curtis, correct me if I'm wrong, but motor vehicle is the one that assesses that penalty and does somewhat of the discovery on that.
There's going to be different types because Commerce will also have some ad violations that could be in play. But the list, and we provided a copy of both the statute that covers that, both the civil penalty for the violation, and then on the second page has the rule, which is R877-23V-7. If it is one of those things, it would be imposed by our division. If it's something that Commerce would regulate in their advertisement, then they would do that.
Okay. Thank you. The real question was, is it's some people have been fined. There's an escalation clause in that fine that per violation, the fine goes up and then hits a maximum of $5,000 for each fine. The comment that was a little maybe disturbing to me was some of the dealers that may be the ones that are most blatant about violation are saying, doesn't matter to me, it's a cost of doing business for me. The difficulty for most dealers is they want to comply by the law and they want to do things the right way, and yet it makes the playing field a little bit unlevel. I'd be the smartest man in America if I had an answer for it. I don't.
Well, but this is a topic, John, that has been
forever. I know that.
I mean, at least at one point in time in every year that I've sat on this board, we've had issues regarding advertising violations and fines.
I guess I'm not asking for any changes or actions to take place today. I'm just asking maybe the possibility that after a certain length of time and someone's been punished two or three times without any regard to it, is there something else that could be done, more teeth put into it that makes a dealer look at it a little differently?
And maybe help explaining what happens now May answer a little bit of it, and I can go back as far as I've been here on the discussion of the board. With it, an advertisement violation is a level 3 violation. The first offense for that in a 12-month period is $250. The second offense goes to $1,000. The third offense goes to $5,000. And if there's any more offenses in that year, it would be an additional $5,000. Part of the comments in dealing with those violations and going way back to when Larry Miller was part of the board is his feeling and the board's feeling at the time was you've got to remember there's little guys too.
Oh yeah.
And a $5,000 fine for a little guy may put him out of business. And so the graduated penalty was set just for that reason. And by the second and third $5,000, I haven't had necessarily the same answer from the dealers. The first one, yeah, you hear it's maybe the cost of doing business. The second, it's not so much. And by the third that happens, I don't see that same violation again.
Okay.
That doesn't mean that it can't be changed, and we may get help from Commissioner Cragen on the explanation of how you would change these rules. If you are changing the civil penalty for the violation, that is within statute. So that would take a legislative change. A rule itself, which is the second page of those. One thing that I did do that, if you want to look, I highlighted some of the ones that we've been seeing a lot of, and they're red. And then if you go to the third, when it talks about underselling claims, this is one that's always been difficult for the division. Because, and I'm sure each of you could get in the newspaper, get on TV right now, and you'll see every one of these things being said. Mm-hmm. And yet it can't be said. The problem is the yellow. That unless somebody complains about that with evidence that it's not true, I cannot take any action against them. So we have in the rule, don't do this, but you can do it until somebody complains about it. And so if those are truly things that the industry doesn't want said, I think that maybe M should be looked at. And if you don't want it said, take out that disclaimer, because once we see that that's been said, we could take action. But right now, the way it's written is we can't take action unless somebody comes in and shows that it's not true. And that doesn't happen.
In order for them to take action, they need to bring tear sheets from papers or electronic media or something of that nature. Is that correct?
Or something saying, here was the ad. They said they are, we will guarantee
$300 more.
And here is this. I went to this dealer, and this dealer said, no, I can do it for this.
Okay.
And the, the consumer isn't going to do that.
No, I agree. Yeah.
It's just they would rather get that less amount when they go to the other person. And so that's one of the things that makes it difficult for us to be able to do on some of those. But again, each one of these, especially this section, has been gone over and continues to be revised, looked at. But if you change the actual civil penalties, it would take a legislative change.
Thank you for the explanation. I spent time on the new car dealers board with Larry, and I always remember that great advocate for the whole group, not just new car dealer or the very smallest used car dealer, but everyone, and I appreciate that. This wasn't an issue that I needed to have enough information that I could go back to a couple dealers and just say, this is what the state of Utah does, and this is what's required, and here's what the law is. And I know, John, from your standpoint, this situation has been, it's talked about every year. It's talked about every year in the new car dealer association.
Well, largely the reason why we have the graduated fee or penalty is because of recommendations that came through this board. And we would wait to hear back from the enforcement division for feedback from them before we changed it. And the reason why they would feed back is if they felt like those penalties were not being effective any longer. And based upon what you're saying, Curtis, is that near as you can tell, they have been helpful in deterring the repeat offender.
It definitely has helped, yes.
Okay. And so is it your opinion that we wouldn't really need to change it from this point?
I don't believe that it needs to be, the actual penalty needs to be addressed. I think that again, with a first and a second and a third, there may be, but beyond that, they will come to the commission, appeal it, and request for, if you remember not too long ago, that was something that was put into rule about being able to decrease that, and it wouldn't decrease it below the lowest level, and that was put into rule also. One thing that may be very beneficial is if Commissioner Cragen could explain the process to change a rule, and that's something then you can decide whether or not it's something you want to look at doing.
Thank you again, Michael Cragen from the Tax Commission. I do have a couple of other comments I'd like to make on this topic, but first I'll answer your question. For the rulemaking, the State Tax Commission adopts these rules, and we have to go through a procedure if we're going to amend those rules. And the first thing that has to happen is that we have to have a draft amendment. We have to know what it's going to change to. So your board could make a request to make X change to this rule. That would come to us at one of our public meetings, and we would vote whether or not we want to send it up to the Division of Administrative Rules, which is part of the Department of Administrative Services. Once we send it to the division, they publish it. If we send it up on the first of the month, then they publish it on the 15th of the month in the Utah Bulletin. And then it's out in public for 30 days comment. After the end of that 30 days public comment period, the commission has to wait 7 days, and then it can take action on the amendment. And at that point, they can adopt the amendment as it's written. They can take into account public comment and make another revision, or they can choose to just let the proposal die without taking any action. So it's actually about a 45 to 60 day process to make a change in the rules, and we have to go through that public process so that everybody knows what's going on and has a chance to give their input, but you don't have to wait until a general legislative session and go through that process.
But if we wanted to send something to you to make a change in rule, that would have to be an action item on our agenda.
It wouldn't have to come from this board. It could come from anybody. It could come from the Used Car Association, the New Car Association. It may not hurt to have this board be in favor. I don't know the commissioner.
I think that it would, no matter where it comes from, my sense is that the Tax Commission is going to ask this board what they think before we do anything. And so that will have to be considered in one of your public meetings.
Okay.
In order for you to, any one of you can come and give your personal opinions, but for this board to give its opinion, it has to be done in a public meeting and put on the agenda.
You had a couple of other items.
Yeah, I wanted to just make a couple of observations on this. You know, the tax commissioners see the appeals that come from these violations. One thing I was thinking about as I sat there is, we don't know how many of these violations were the dealer just actually writes a check and pays the fine, but we see the appeals from them. And something that you need to keep in mind, or at least let the industry take some comfort in, is that the division is usually pretty judicious in the way that they issue fines. Many times there will be evidence of 5 or 6 consecutive violations of something when the division finds that, and they'll issue 1 ticket for those 6 violations, where if they really wanted to be, you know, follow the law technically, they could issue 6 violations. It would be a first one, a second one, and 4 third ones, and the fine would be huge. The rule that we adopted, the Tax Commission said, in that kind of a situation, we are willing to consider reducing the penalties, but in no account would we ever reduce it less than the 250. So in that situation that I gave you, we might be willing to say, well, you're going to pay 250 times six because you had six of those violations. Those don't come to us, as I say, because the division is usually pretty careful in the way that they issue their citations. They want to educate the people, the public, the dealers, the licensees, to know you can't do this and there's a fine for doing it. Don't ever do it again. They're not trying to fund the division with these citations. So that's what I wanted to say. Thanks.
And how often are you having?
We get a small handful of appeals a year. I would say half a dozen, maybe, of licensing violations. Most of the
just take those on a case by case basis.
They just go through our appeals process. We do tend to expedite the appeals that come in these matters, because especially when you're dealing with licenses, it's holding up somebody's ability to do business.
Thank you.
If you'll just stay there for a second, because
sure.
I may have a couple other questions. John, if you'll allow me to piggyback on your item here. So if you could open up to that R877-23V7, and if you would come down to paragraph 2C, where it says price, when the price or payment of a motor vehicle is quoted, this is on advertising, what has to be quoted within advertising. The motor vehicle shall be clearly identified as to make, year, model, and if new or used, except as provided in subsection C. The advertised price must include charges that the customer must pay for the motor vehicle, including freight or destination charges, dealer prep, and dealer handling. And then subsequently it states what doesn't have to list, such as dealer document or fees, undercoating, rust proofing, taxes and fees. So I've been approached by dealers who are wondering why we have freight and destination charges as a must be in the advertising, and documentary fees as a not has to be in advertising. Basically, what they're saying is that it's just becoming much more difficult to make profit on the front end. Everything's going on the back end. And they want the freight charges to move to a front end item to a back end item. They want to be able to advertise the car without having to advertise destination charges. They say in the new car industry, part of the MSRP includes destination charges, but not for a used car. See? So they're able to take advantage of that because their destination fees are included in the MSRP. For us, it's not. They want that to be made as a change so that it does not have to be disclosed in advertising. Now, when I say they, I'm saying a few dealers, and I'm not so sure that even everybody is on the board wanting to be that. I just wanted to get your feeling as to why that ended up that way, and if there would be a problem to change that rule.
I can tell you that I don't know why that's in the rule.
That way.
That
probably
way.
Just when we were putting it together one day, we just...
Right.
John, could I make one comment on
yes.
that? The new car dealers are... There was a time in my life when we had vehicles come in, particularly trucks, that didn't have an MSRP in the window. That became federally mandated. And so we're all regulated off of a MSRP now that has a destination in it. A used automobile dealer, which is where I cut my teeth, there is no MSRP.
Right.
And consequently, whatever quote you have is your MSRP. In other words, if I bought a car for $10,000 and determined that I wanted to mark it up $2,500, there's no regulation to that.
Right.
So for me to see this and say, I can add my fees in anywhere I want or deduct them out anywhere I want as a dealer without a structured MSRP, it's hard for me to see why that would have much relevance.
Well, here's the relevance. in advertising, in order for the advertising to be correct, you'd have to list the price as such and such plus so much.
I see what you're saying.
For a destination charge, okay? And they don't want it to be an issue of advertising.
I see.
Furthermore, the market sets the price. I mean, you can set that price whatever you want, but the market sets the price. And sometimes a customer is less reticent to fight over 10.5 than 10.7. You understand what I'm saying? And have it be 10.5 plus a $200 destination fee. Maybe that's easier for them to sell than just having to put it in the price and now the price is 10.7. See what I'm saying? Because the market sets the price. And I don't know.
So you're only talking about used car dealers?
Pretty much, yeah. They don't want to have to list destination fees in their advertising.
This is Curtis. A couple things, I don't know if they will affect the decision or not. One thing that has happened with dock fees is there was a class action lawsuit on that. Don't know if this would put that in with destination charges, because they're talking about with the dock fees, it was a service. That would be an attorney that would probably need to look at that to see, because that's been an issue for probably 7-8 years-ish now, and that's still going. Second, with complaints that we get, if it wasn't included and you charge, the most complaints that we get as a division are things that are added on after. One of the things, and I know it doesn't really have to do with this, if you look on this page, and it's the next page over, the first red section, it talks about savings and discount claims, and it says, because the intrinsic value of a used motor vehicle is difficult to establish, specific claims of savings may not be used in advertisement. This includes statements such as was priced at, now priced at. With that, it's very true with the intrinsic value of a used car. As the industry, you know, I could look at NADA and get a value. I could look at Kelley Blue Book. It won't be the same. I could look at Black Book. I could look at, there's numerous places to look. And when I think the rules were made, it was to simplify that. The value that you're willing to put as an advertised price is whatever you want with used. You can't reference that it, NADA is this, because if you're willing to sell it for less, that was the value of that car, not what NADA said. If you decide to or not, that's up to the dealer. So I think it may be something that makes it more difficult when it comes time to that consumer being happy. And I would look at it as we would probably get a lot more complaints with them adding on other things after.
Obviously, but the dealers that are coming and saying we don't want that are not necessarily considering the happiness of their customers as much as how to maximize their own profitability. This also brings up a sales tax issue, because then if the price of the car is $10.5 and we're going to charge $200 for a destination fee, is the destination fee a taxable item or a non-taxable item?
I don't know the answer.
I think that's also in Pub 5.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But so we've had consumers call. The salvage brand has to be disclosed in advertising, because we had a lady drive from St. George to Bountiful area and was frustrated because they had spent 4 hours
We addressed that specifically.
Right, the same thing with the destination. If I got to a dealer and I had driven 4 hours and now you're telling me I have a destination charge on a used car that you probably bought at an auction across town, and now I'm having to pay a $500 freight charge. Freight charge for what on a used car? It came from 3 miles away, or
and
it was a trade-in
right.
to you.
And then that's another can of worms, I
yeah.
understand.
Right.
But there are dealers that buy cars in Salt Lake, and there are dealers that also buy cars in many states.
Right, but shouldn't the public know that before they step on your lot, this is what the fees are, with the exception of the couple that are listed?
Maybe the best way to respond to this way. We charge a documentary fee, it's the same fee. We charge it to everybody, therefore it's not a subjective fee. When you get into destination charges, you're not going to charge some destination charge to one person as another because the destination charges may have been different, and maybe the best way is to explain that's why it's excluded.
And for me, the destination charge really is part of the cost of the vehicle.
Right.
Truly, when you put on your books, that's how you would assume that. I think that's the reason that this was written, that dealer documentation fee was maybe the only thing undisclosed. And part of that is because, number one, it's a very sensitive issue. And number two, unfortunately, it's all over the board. Because
yeah.
You
can argue up and down one side or the other whether or not a dealer documentary fee is truly a cost of the vehicle as well.
Yeah.
But I think the difference here comes from the fact that it's uniform. You charge it to everyone.
They don't have to, though. The statute just says you have to post it.
Well, and again, I think that gets into the class action lawsuit of it being a service, and you can't have that unless it truly is the cost of what it costs the dealer to do. I know the new dealer side many times has said, you should sit down, you should look at the electrical cost, the cost of the desk, the cost of that person, and divide it out for what you are charging as your doc fee. I hope the industry has done that, because who knows what will happen with that. And if you are one of those dealers who hasn't sat down and done that, when the class action suit comes and you're charging a service, it may cost the dealership a lot of money.
Who's hearing that?
I think it's in Davis County. I think the dealer was up in Layton, if I remember right.
Actually in Woods Cross, where this class action suit started. But I think most dealers have it posted within their finance office or somewhere in public display that gives full description or disclosure of what a documentation fee is, and so that they justify that additional money.
So then I'm taking it would be the opinion of the enforcement division that it's best left where it is.
I think the division would stand by that, yes.
Okay. If I may respond to your question, the dealers that you're talking about are certainly free to ask the tax commission to consider changing the rule. And then we'll go through the process that I described. We would probably take the additional step of contacting the trade organization board, the Independent Dealers Association, and asking that board to give us their opinion on it. We would ask your opinion on it, and then it would be out for public comment for 30 days as well. So as long as they understand what they're asking for, they're welcome to ask.
Okay.
And we'll consider whether or not to make a change.
Well, they want the board to, they want the Independent Dealers Association to address this. But I'm not saying that they're on board with it.
Sure.
I'm just saying that it's an item that's come before them. And
right.
I've been asked to try to get some ground rules as to why it is where it is. I think we've been able to do that today.
But if that doesn't satisfy the members,
then they can certainly
tell
go
them
ahead
that they
and
can
come
to talk
the tax
to us.
Commission and,
mm-hmm.
and ask you to change it.
Right. And
okay.
We, at the beginning of every one of our meetings, we have a time for public comment. 3 minutes on any topic that they want to talk about, as long as it doesn't involve an appeal. So,
okay.
If they want to be heard, they can be heard.
All right.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And John, just so you know, I probably fine about 6 dealers a month administratively for advertising, but most of them don't appeal advertising.
6 a month?
Probably. That's probably pretty average.
And you're not aware of any?
We have had comments about the first 5,000. Again, once it gets to the second, it's not as, the same comment was not made, I guess is what I can say. which.
And it never got to the third.
They've gotten to the third before.
Yeah. But not for the same thing.
The same thing, but different.
For a violation.
Correct. May have said free and something, and may have said, so it was multiple things. Usually after the third, one thing that the division has always done and will continue to do is they can email us the advertisement. We will proof it to see if it's has problems and let them know. We usually require that they do that a couple days in advance so that we have time, because with the new email system, it goes into spam a lot of times and we have to wait to get it out. But that particular dealer now does that. And it almost gets to be where we're fixing their ads for them.
Yeah, they don't even try to comply.
They just
they wait
send
for
us
to
a national ad and say, here, does this work?
When you said you fine, basically you're just responding to citations.
They're actually not a citation. They can write a citation for it, but it's only a Class B misdemeanor. And so
so how do you decide then who?
We always do the civil penalty because it gets, well, it gets it fixed.
Well, usually on the criminal side, if it's their first, it'll get dismissed.
So we just do the civil penalty instead of civil and criminal. It says we can do both, but we've never done both. It's one or the other, and usually it's the civil violation.
And I'll try Craig again real quick for you.
Jenny, is that public knowledge of who gets fined?
No.
Okay.
Used to get published, didn't it?
Yeah, and then we found out it wasn't public.
Craig, this is the advisory board. You're now on speaker with everyone here.
Thanks for trying me in. I appreciate it first.
We tried you earlier and we didn't get through, so we probably had most of the discussion without you.
Well, it's probably better without me anywhere.
How are you, Craig?
Good. Sorry I'm not there. I just had an idea. Started tomorrow, but I have meetings today, so.
It's okay.
Took me a later flight out. They got me here where I needed to be, so I apologize.
So we're going to just basically, for the lack of a better term, table the issue with regards to brokering for right now. It doesn't sound like that the association wants to do much with that right at this time.
You know, we don't. We have our plate full with some things that are we understand are coming legislatively. So we didn't put any energy there because of what was upcoming, or at least what we perceived as.
Well, that's a new car issue, and if you want to address it again, then I guess put it on the agenda for another time.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Did you have an item or two that you wanted to share with us today?
No, there's just some franchise issues that are there. Just from the industry, we've been in conversations legislatively with different legislators and different task forces, whether it's the Transportation Committee or the highway users. You know, we belong to several groups. And just from an informational standpoint, you know, transportation funding and gas taxes and indexing taxes of gas and so forth have been talked about, you know, and I don't know that anybody has come to a conclusion on what they're going to do. The House has one version, I think the Senate has another. But we've been following those, but we've not gone on either direction because it's still in the formulated stage. So that's one of the things that seems from a transportation is looming the biggest.
Okay. Well, I'm sure you and Wayne are watching things on the Hill for us. You always do a good job with that. If there's anything that comes up that is of an emergency in nature, be sure to let us know.
Certainly will. Absolutely.
Okay. All right, Craig. We just wanted to make sure if there was anything else you had a chance.
No, that was the shortest meeting I did too.
Well, that's good.
Enjoy San Francisco.
All righty.
Thank you. Okay, are there any other board member items? Dave, have you got anything that you need to discuss today?
I don't, thank you.
Well, we appreciate your attendance. You got anything that
No, sir.
We need to bring? Are there any other items from the Tax Commission? All right, well, we appreciate your attendance to our meeting. Did you have anything else, Curtis?
Nope.
Where's Kent today?
He does apologize. He was sick and didn't want to get everybody sick, so he said he was staying away.
I understand.
He didn't want enough to infect all of us.
Well, of course. And I'll just mention that Wayne Jones would have been here to this meeting, but he was sick as well today, and so he asked to be excused. So if there are no other items, then I'd like to entertain a motion to adjourn. We have a motion and a second?
Second.
Thank you, John. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Thank you.